On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman was found guilty of fatally attacking her 2.5-year-old daughter.
I grabbed her by the neck and I choked her and I hit her repeatedly. I put her in bed and I hit her.
She had bruises on her face. She had a cut lip, bruises on her collarbone, neck, chest, her abdomen, her legs.
Then, Susan DiAquila tells her story. She was convicted of murder for pushing her disabled husband into a river.
All of a sudden, it was like splash. Everything seemed like it went in slow motion.
Tony went underwater and came up and said, "Help me, please help me."
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Peggy Hilt and Susan DiAquila. On the morning of Saturday, July 2, 2005, Peggy Hilt called 911 when her 2.5-year-old adopted daughter Nina stopped breathing in her arms. But paramedics arrived to find the child was no longer alive. Cause of death? Blunt force trauma to the abdomen.
She had bruises around her collarbone. Her small intestine had ruptured. This all indicated a severe beating.
Did Nina's injuries result from an accident on the stairs, as Peggy claimed? Or was she, in fact, a victim of her mother's uncontrollable rage? Peggy Hilt was born in 1972 in Ogdensburg, New York.
I had 5 brothers and sisters. It was a relatively normal family. My father suffered with alcoholism. My father could get verbally abusive at times when he was drinking, but it wasn't a traumatic childhood.
But Peggy struggled throughout her adolescence. By the age of 12, Peggy became a secret drinker.
I was teased at school. Our family was on the poor side. You know, we didn't have the latest clothes. I was just not part of the in crowd. I suffered from depression in high school. At one time, I tried to commit suicide, and the school brought in a counselor to talk to me, but I refused.
Hilt's lifeline was caring for children.
I loved children. I spent all of my time babysitting. There were a couple families that I had full-time jobs with, and always imagined myself getting married and having a lot of children.
Peggy then went to college, where she met her husband, Chris, and the couple married in 1994. A year later, the Hilts moved to Fairfax, Virginia, and tried to have a baby.
We went through 4 years of painful, heartbreaking fertility tests and treatments.
After 6 years of unsuccessful attempts, 29-year-old Peggy and 31-year-old Chris Hilt adopted a baby girl named Natalia from an orphanage in the Ukraine.
Natalia was a dream come true. She fulfilled me. Mommyhood was better than I ever imagined it was going to be.
The Hilts effortlessly bonded with their new daughter. 3 years later, they decided to adopt again. Because the adoption process had changed in the Ukraine, the couple applied to Russia. On January 27, 2004, Peggy and Chris adopted 16-month-old Nina from an orphanage in Siberia.
The Russian system has well over 600,000-700,000 children that are in orphanage care that they cannot care for. They're all deprived. They're all lacking in appropriate caretaking. Food and nutrition is poor. Medical care is poor.
But soon after they brought Nina home, Peggy claims she realized right away that something was wrong.
It's to be expected that any child coming out of an institutional setting, especially deprived Eastern Bloc countries, is going to have special needs.
We get home with Nina. Some of her emotional difficulties started to come about right away. When I tried to hold her or love her, she was very defiant.
Unlike their first child, Peggy says she struggled to bond with Nina. The 32-year-old mother soon became overwhelmed by her daughter's alleged emotional and behavioral problems. Peggy claims she did her best to make it work, but never sought help from doctors.
She would cry and push away. I assumed it was something I was doing wrong or not doing right.
Reactive detachment disorder is a condition that sometimes impacts children who have been institutionalized.
They often will have trouble with attaching to others, meaning they prefer to be left alone and isolated, and they're difficult to soothe and comfort.
Nina had sort of a shadowy quality to her, where she was there, but she wasn't nearly as outgoing or as rambunctious as Natalia. And Nina always hung back and was quiet.
However, Nina did show another side to some.
She was always attached to me. She always wanted me to hold her and pick her up, carry her around. I always wanted to give hugs. She was a sweet little girl.
As the primary caretaker, Peggy continued to be frustrated with her inability to bond with Nina and turned to her husband for help. However, Chris did not have the same negative experience with their adopted daughter.
He saw the difficulties that she gave me and that we had together, but she did not give him the same difficulties. I thought she hated me. I didn't know what to do. I thought whatever it was, time and love, would fix it.
Peggy probably thought she could develop a love for this child too over time and bond, but that never occurred. She never was able to bond with this child.
Peggy claims Nina became more difficult to deal with. As a result, her own problems began to spiral out of control.
I had started drinking more. Nina's problems were becoming more evident. She would have rages. She left huge bruised bite marks on Natalia a number of times.
Peggy says her husband thought a change of scenery would help. In August 2004, the Hilts moved to Wake Forest, North Carolina, but the plan backfired.
We made a very bad choice to move to North Carolina. It only deepened my depression, cut us off further from our friends and family. I was severely depressed and couldn't figure out why I couldn't make this child love me. I was becoming more bitter towards her too because my days were spent with fix, clean up, and undo what she had destroyed or done.
Peggy's resentment toward Nina built and their relationship worsened.
Peggy seemed somehow dismissive of Nina. She didn't have the kind of loving relationship that she seemed to have with Natalia. It was sort of like she considered Natalia to be special and Nina just to be there.
In a twist of fate, Peggy learned she was pregnant in January 2005. But 3 months later, she suffered a miscarriage.
I did not seek counseling, which I really should have. It just reinforced everything, I think, bad that I felt about myself. That I was not good, that I was not worthy, that I was broken. You know, here I've already got this child that I can't even love me. And everything went downhill from there.
Once again, Peggy admits she turned to drinking to console her pain.
I remember there was a couple days where I actually had drank a case of beer myself in a day. I think Chris wanted the perfect family so bad that he saw what he wanted to see. I hid my drinking. He knew I was drinking, but he had no idea I was drinking as much as I was.
The situation reached a crisis on July 1st, 2005. While her husband was at work, Peggy was at home with her daughters, preparing for a trip to visit relatives.
Nina was having a very difficult day, and I was drinking and trying to get everything ready. And we had been taking toys up and downstairs.
Peggy says Nina tumbled while playing on the stairs.
She had bruises on her face where she had fallen. It was just a very rough day for her, so I thought maybe she was not feeling well and just being worse than usual.
A couple hours later, Hilt says Nina attacked her sister, Natalia. Peggy became enraged.
Both girls were sitting on the table and something happened and Nina grabbed a fork and went after Natalia. And I just saw red and I grabbed Nina and I took her upstairs. She was kicking and screaming and I lost it. It happened so fast. It was just like a tornado, like a rage, you know, just whoosh.
When Women Behind Bars continues, Peggy calls 911, begging for help.
Oh my God!
Okay, man.
Help me!
In January 2004, Peggy and Chris Hilt adopted a 16-month-old girl named Nina from an orphanage in Russia. But Peggy failed to bond with her new daughter. The young mother claims that her difficult relationship with Nina caused her to drink more heavily. In July of 2005, Nina allegedly bit her older sister, Natalia, an incident which Peggy says made her lose control. She flew into a rage.
She brought her up to Nina's bedroom. She grabbed the child around the throat. She lifted her up off the floor. She shook the child.
I grabbed her by the neck and I choked her and I hit her repeatedly. I put her in bed and I hit her.
Peggy says she left the bruised 2.5-year-old lying on the bed, walked out of the room, and shut the door behind her. Nina stayed alone in her room for 3 hours.
I felt horrible. I couldn't believe that I had just lost it like that. The rest of the day I spent sobering up, finished getting ready for the trip, taking care of Natalia. When Chris called and said he was on his way home, I went up and got Nina.
At 5:30 p.m., when her husband Chris returned, Peggy lied about the cause of Nina's injuries.
She had covered up a lot of her body so Christopher couldn't see.
He saw the bruises on her face, and I told him that she had fallen on the stairs, but he couldn't see the bruises on her back.
They continued to prepare for their trip to Virginia, and Nina was going to her father complaining of a stomach ache, and she was starting to have a fever.
During the 4-hour drive to Manassas, Virginia, to visit relatives, Nina began to show signs of physical distress.
A little while into the trip, she had vomited. I did not realize or could believe that I hurt her that bad.
Still, the young mother was intent on hiding Nina's injuries from her husband.
When I changed her clothes the first time, I made sure that I took her outside of the van and changed her clothes so Chris couldn't see the marks on her back.
Peggy Hilt went to great lengths, not only en route to Virginia, but once she arrived in Manassas, to hide the bruising and injuries that she inflicted on Nina.
Throughout the night, Nina's condition worsened.
She seemed like she was a little kid with a fever, you know, just kind of lethargic and out of it. I didn't connect hitting her and her being sick.
The next morning, Nina couldn't keep anything down.
Obviously, her body was not mending. It was starting to break down.
By 9 a.m., everyone left the house but Peggy, who stayed behind to be with Nina.
She still hadn't had anything to eat, and I was worried. I was sitting in the rocking chair with her in the living room, and she was drinking her sippy cup. And she just kind of stopped and kind of went limp. That's when I got scared. I could tell she wasn't breathing, and so I ran back inside and laid her on the floor and called 911.
911, where is your emergency?
Oh my gosh, my baby didn't breathe.
Okay, what's your address? What is your address?
I don't. We're at my friend's house. It's on Kimberly Drive.
I was doing CPR on her and she had thrown up.
Okay.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
Ma'am?
I think, oh my God!
Okay, ma'am.
Help me!
Ma'am, I'm trying to tell you what to do.
The ambulance arrived 10 minutes after Peggy called 911. But when Nina Hilt's body arrived at the local hospital, authorities summoned the police.
And when we got there, they took us into a room and told us that she had died.
She had bruises on her face. She had a cut lip. She had bruises on her collarbone, neck, her abdomen, her legs.
When questioned by the police, Peggy stuck to her original story.
She talked about what had happened at their home on Friday afternoon in Wake Forest, and that Nina had been carrying toys up the stairs, and that she had fallen backwards.
They let us see Nina's body.
Chris Christopher just looked down at his daughter and looked at Peggy, and he couldn't believe what he saw. And Peggy just looked at me and made eye contact with me.
On Sunday, July 3rd, an autopsy performed on Nina Hilt revealed that the cause of death was blunt force trauma to the abdomen.
The autopsy clarified the fact that it was definitely a homicide.
The police called Peggy in for more questioning.
I don't remember much of anything except the police did call us the next day and wanted us to come to the station and answer questions.
24 hours after her daughter died, Peggy recalls having a sudden realization that she had caused Nina's death.
I woke up and I sat up in bed and said, oh my God, I did this. I hurt her bad.
The next morning, Peggy finally told her husband the truth.
I told him what had happened. He just started crying and crying. Well, he was supportive and distant. He was hurt and shocked, confused.
After consulting with her lawyer, Peggy confessed to the police.
She started right away with, I hurt Nina.
I was pretty sure that I had caused Nina's death. And I needed to be held accountable.
On Wednesday, July 6th, 2005, Detective Kathleen Olschlegel interviewed Peggy Hilt for 3 hours.
Was anybody else in the home on Friday around 2:30 when this was happening? Natalia. Where was she in the residence?
One thing in the interview that sort of stood out was when she speaks about the bonding with Nina and how they just could never bond and how she felt that this child preferred anybody else in the world to her.
Ever since we brought Nina home, we never bonded.
The motive was ultimately the lack of bonding and the resentment and anger towards her child.
Authorities charged Peggy with second-degree murder and incarcerated her in the county jail.
Peggy Hilt appeared in circuit court and pled guilty to second-degree murder.
In the sentencing phase, the defense argued that Peggy was a troubled woman who should have sought help for her problems.
Her attorney had mentioned that she had been grappling with alcoholism and apparently had just not been in full control of her emotions at the time.
Prosecutor Paul Ebert argued for a stiff sentence for Peggy's role in Nina's lethal beating.
Initially, Paul Ebert had asked for a harsh sentence and saying that there was no excuse for what she had done.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
The Russians wanted to see me severely punished.
Nina Hilt's death marked the 14th death of a child adopted from Russia in the U.S.
And later in this episode of Women Behind Bars, a woman is accused of killing her husband for his pension money by pushing him into a river.
Tony went underwater and came up and said, help me, please help me.
On my mother's grave, that never happened.
On March 1st, 2006, Peggy Hilt pleaded guilty to second-degree murder for the fatal beating of her 2.5-year-old daughter, Nina, who was adopted from Russia. Meanwhile, after Nina's tragic death, Russian authorities called for a hold on adoptions to the United States.
There was a lot of uproar just from people in Russia being upset about the impression that children were being brought to the U.S., adopted by families here, and then being abused and killed. One group that was particularly upset were those parents in the U.S. that wanted to adopt children from Russia. And because of the distrust between authorities there, a lot of these adoptions were put on hold.
As the trial began, an outraged public cried out for a severe sentence for 34-year-old Peggy Hilt.
And so you had a lot of frustrated parents here that were waiting to bring their children home from Russia. And they were upset. They wanted to see a harsh sentence in this case. She was very quiet. We didn't see many emotions. When she did say, I'm sorry, it was barely audible.
At that time, Judge Hamblin handed down a sentence of 35 years with 10 suspended, and Peggy would serve 25 years.
Three months later, Hilt's attorney presented a motion to further reduce Peggy's prison term. He argued that the international media attention may have had an impact on Hilt's original sentence. The judge granted the motion and shortened Peggy's prison term from 25 years to 19 years. The public was divided on the outcome.
I know that people in other countries, politicians, the Russians wanted to see me severely punished.
The fact that Peggy Hilt will serve minimum 19 years in prison is something that I think people felt that justice was served in that sentence.
Personally, I don't think that's a fair sentence. I think she should get more time for what she did to Nina.
Some of those people who are angry with me, you know, may have found themselves in the same situation. I never in a million years would have dreamed myself in that type of a situation, and here I sit.
Peggy Hilt violated the most sacred trust a child has in a parent, and that is to keep them safe and provide a loving environment. 19 years is not enough for Peggy Hilt.
The people that hate me, I can't even feel compassion for them because I used to be just like them. Anybody that could or would hurt a child, you know, should be locked away. I couldn't fathom it. Now I can see things gonna happen that you don't mean. Addiction is a bad thing.
Since her incarceration, Peggy has achieved sobriety and has found comfort through spirituality.
I am in some religious classes. I strongly believe that God used this tragedy to save me because I'm supposed to help other people.
The death of Nina has left a permanent impact on the Hilt family. Peggy and Chris Hilt have divorced. Chris retains custody of their other daughter, Natalia, who was adopted from the Ukraine.
This is not only a tragedy for the child, definitely for the child, and for the family that's left behind, Mr. Hilt raising the other child.
So he lost two people in his life, and that has got to be extremely devastating.
According to Peggy, Chris and their daughter, Natalia, have suspended their visitations for now.
Chris visited me early on in jail. Then they moved away from the area, and when Natalia is strong enough and ready to come to see me, he'll bring her.
Peggy hopes that her case will raise awareness for parents who are seeking to adopt internationally.
I would like to see many things changed in the adoption world, because those children do need to get out of those orphanages, but they need to be adopted into prepared therapeutic families.
Peggy Hilt is responsible for the death of her child. I think she's accepted that responsibility and admitted that, but there are a lot of what-ifs here. What if the Hilt family had received pre-adoptive education, would have changed their decision to adopt? What if they had been prepared for the challenges of raising a child that may have been impacted by institutionalization? You know, we'll never know, and it may have made a difference in the life of a child.
I did something horrible that I wish I could undo, and I can't. But I hope I'll be able to help somebody behind me, because that's the only thing I can do for Nina at this point, is to hopefully help somebody behind us.
Peggy will be 50 years old when she's released from prison.
I did not mean to hurt Nina. I certainly did not mean for her to die. But I need to be punished. Other people need to see me punished. To let them know that it's not okay. Never okay to hit a child. If you need help, get it, no matter what you have to do.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
I mean, he tried to kill my daughter.
There was witness testimony that Susan said, "We're gonna murder him. Get the hell out of here."
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to www.wetv.com. On May 31, 1986, police pulled the body of 56-year-old Tony D'Aquila from the Des Plaines River, an apparent accidental drowning.
His shoes, shirt, even his glasses were relatively folded up nice and neatly on the top of the wall here.
But questions began to surface about the victim's troubled marriage to his wife, Susan, an openly gay woman who was 25 years his junior.
Tony was a vulnerable type person, and she was just sort of someone who would take advantage of him.
Susan DiAquila was a con woman who orchestrated this entire set of circumstances to get his money.
Was this a tragic accident, or did Susan DiAquila commit a deliberate act of murder? Susan DiAquila grew up the second youngest in a family with seven children on Chicago's South Side. She was just 8 years old when her father died in 1963.
I went from being a child to I felt like I was an adult, trying to help out my mom.
Susie and I were very, very close. Susie was always trying to do things for people, and she'd go to the dinner table and grab food off the table, and I'll be right back. She's supposed to be eating dinner, and she goes, and we found her on 19th and Washtenaw feeding the homeless underneath the sidewalks. She was just a giving person, loving, giving, caring.
As she got older, Susan knew that she was different.
I knew she was gay. Yeah, she always had girlfriends, same-sex girlfriends.
Kept it a secret until I was about 15. One day my mom caught me with a woman, and she took me to every counselor, psychiatrist. She finally said, "I give up. If this is what you are, then fine."
One brief relationship with a boy at age 15 left Susan pregnant with a daughter, Victoria.
My mom was gay, and my grandmother didn't want me to live in that environment, so my grandparents raised me.
Susan let her mom take care of the baby and moved out on her own to make a life for herself.
I did odd jobs, you know, working in cars, bartending for one of the bars in the neighborhood.
Susan was in her mid-20s when she met Tony DiAquila, a longtime groundskeeper for the Forest Preserve in a suburb of Chicago.
He was 50 years old, and then he became my best friend in the whole world.
Tony was a man of short in stature, but big in heart. He was the type of fella that would go out of his way for anybody.
Tony DiAquila suffered physical challenges that set him apart from others.
Tony had scoliosis, he had arthritic hands, he had clubbed feet.
He wore special shoes. They almost looked like stilted boots, but they definitely had compensating heels and soles on them so that he could walk.
And yet he worked every day for the Cook County Forest Preserve and was a very good worker and a very hard worker.
He introduced me to Susan, and he just sort of looked up at her with like this sick puppy love type of look. I don't think that he ever had a girlfriend until he met Susan.
After a five-year friendship, 30-year-old Susan and 56-year-old Tony surprised everyone by getting married in November 1985. But Tony's co-workers and friends suspected that something was not quite right about the new marriage.
I was sort of uncomfortable with her because I knew that Tony was a vulnerable type person, and she looked like she was just sort of someone who would take advantage of him.
We all knew that this woman was, because of her age and because of his afflictions, we knew that there was something wrong right from the start.
Questions were raised in terms of the relationship in general, or what her motivation was originally to marry Tony.
He didn't make a lot of money, but he worked his entire life, and he had his pension recently increased.
Susan denies the marriage was for money. In fact, she says she and Tony married to keep a secret he hid from everyone.
Tony was gay too, secretly gay, you know, and he goes, "We can make this work out. I need to really get married." then they'll leave me alone. So I said, oh, why not?
Tony's friends adamantly deny that he was gay.
I never got an indication that that Tony was gay. As a matter of fact, I think he craved affection from women, and that was why he ended up with Susan, because she was probably one of the few women that paid attention to him.
The newlyweds purchased a home in Cicero, a Chicago suburb, which soon became a boarding house for Susan's down-and-out friends.
If you needed help, my mom would give you her last dollar.
Susan and the cohorts that was surrounding her literally were, in fact, living at that home.
They didn't have no jobs. They were just using both my mom and Tony. It was a free ride to them.
Tony confided in coworkers about the difficulties he was having at home and that he was being mistreated by his new wife and her friends.
He used to come and tell us about how he was beat up, or, you know, you have scars on him. And we said, well, why'd you call the police? He said, but I love her. I love the kid. I love him. I can't do anything to hurt him.
Susan denies any abuse and claims that Tony injured himself in fights that broke out when they were partying.
Tony got into a few bar brawls, and he ended up talking to this real big guy one day, and this guy's gonna beat the hell out of him, and it was me and Tony fighting this big guy.
By April 1986, Tony moved out of the house and took up residence at the Hotel Eleanor, although he continued to visit Susan at their home.
He just didn't like the people. He didn't get along with this one man, James John Sr. They just started clashing.
60-year-old James Johns rented a room in the attic, and Susan remembers would sometimes pick fights with Tony.
James Johns, I didn't like him. I think he was in love with my mom, and my mom didn't want nothing to do with him. She, like, tried to help him, I think, and he just got a little obsessed with her.
On a Thursday night at the end of May, Tony came to the house where everyone was hanging out.
They were drinking during a good portion of the day, and that they were trying to get Tony drunk. Susan and Jimmy Johns and the three other individuals indicated, we're going to take you, Tony, for swimming lessons and get you over this fear of water that you have.
Susan remembers it was Tony's idea to go out to the river.
Well, Tony said, let's go out to the falls because it was beautiful outside.
The group piled into one car and headed out to Hoffman Dam on the Des Plaines River. Along with Susan and Tony were James Johns and three of Susan's friends.
They drove to Riverside and were looking for a place to bring Tony into the water. They parked their car along Fairbanks Road.
The party of six walked two blocks to the riverbank. According to one member of the group, Susan and James Johns helped Tony take off his pants and shoes. But Susan claims she was against the idea all along.
James Johns and Tony, they went into the water and they said, hey, you know, this is, you know, not good, Tony, get out of the water. I had a bad feeling.
Susan says she witnessed James Johns whispering to two members of the group who suddenly walked back to the car.
They realized what was really going down and they decided they should leave. It was wrong and they were gonna go. There was witness testimony that Susan said, we're gonna murder him, get the hell out of here.
When Women Behind Bars continues,
Tony went underwater and came up and said, help me, please help me. And they sat there, the two of them sat there and watched him drown.
On the night of May 29th, 1986, Susan DiAquila and her husband, Tony, drove with four friends to the Des Plaines River. Police believed it was a well-orchestrated ploy by Susan and accomplices to get physically handicapped Tony near deep water, where they could push him in and drown him.
Tony had a fear of water. He couldn't swim. Tony had scoliosis.
People who knew Tony said in addition to the deformed shape of his spine due to the scoliosis, his gnarled hands made it impossible for him to be a strong swimmer.
I think he could have been coaxed to go near the water if that was what Susan wanted him to do. He would do just about anything for her.
Susan recounts that Tony took a brief dip in a shallow portion of the river, then got out and sat next to her on a stone embankment so they could look at the waterfall together.
And he goes, "Wow, doesn't that look beautiful?" I turned and looked, and then all of a sudden I hear a splash. You know, everything like seemed like it went in slow motion.
Susan claims her recollection is cloudy from alcohol and marijuana she used that night.
It took me even a second to realize that Tony's not sitting there no more next to me.
She saw that he was in trouble. She doesn't know how to swim, but she started to take off her shoes. Then I think somebody pulled her away, and the next thing she looked down, she couldn't see him anymore, whether the current pulled him away or he was underwater. She didn't know.
Police paint a different picture of that night. They believe it had all gone according to plan, Susan's plan. Police say that Susan's boarder, James Johns, was smitten with Susan and agreed to help her kill her husband.
That's what they were really trying to do, is to lure him down to that location. You know, give him a good shove and off he floats and not being able to save himself.
But Susan strongly denies involvement in Tony's drowning. She maintains she never saw who pushed Tony into the water, but she believes it was James Johns who acted without any prompting from her.
James Johns is laughing like some kind of a lunatic. The first thing I thought was, "Well, get help." And I remember screaming for somebody to call the cops and banging on this lady's door.
In the chaos of the moment, the group split up. Susan and her friend, David Hurd, took off in one direction.
David's telling me, "We got to get out of here. Jim's gone crazy. You know, like Jim's going to kill me next."
Meanwhile, James drove away in the car with Susan's two other friends.
I said, "David, we got to go to the police. What about Tony?" David said he was going to take care of everything. Just trust me.
David Hurd took Susan to a local bar and made a phone call. Susan says she assumed he was calling 911. But when James and the others met them at the bar, Susan realized that David had called them. She says by this time, her fear of James Johns kept her quiet.
I was never afraid in the beginning of James Johns, but after that, I was terrified.
The five housemates stayed at the bar and drank until closing time. No one ever called the police.
About 1:45 in the afternoon, we were called to the scene of this particular area by the Des Plaines River.
Authorities found Tony D'Aquila floating face down in the water just above the Hoffman Dam.
He was only dressed in white BVDs, briefs, and a t-shirt.
The medical examiner determined that Tony D'Aquila had been dead for 2 days. Police located Susan and informed her of her husband's death.
Her reaction when she was first told that her husband was dead was, "I have a marriage certificate. I'm next of kin."
And then Jimmy Johns, somebody walks up and says, "Did you find Tony near some water?" I was like, "Well, how did they know that?"
Susan told police she was nowhere near the Des Plaines River when Tony drowned. But days later, the investigation turned up indisputable evidence that Susan's car was indeed at the river that night.
There was a parking ticket that was written for a vehicle a little bit further down from where the crime scene is actually. That's pretty damning evidence in terms of at least placing them on the scene.
Susan claims she didn't tell police the truth because James Johns had threatened her daughter.
He goes, "You do what I say or I will kill Victoria." He goes, "You want Vicky dead?" I mean, he threatened to kill my daughter. You know, that's my world.
To confirm their suspicions, police needed someone from Susan's circle of friends to crack.
We surmised that Jimmy Johns might be the weakest link. We asked him to come down to the police department, and he was outside pacing in front of the police department, very, very nervous.
James confessed to police that he and Susan together pushed Tony into the river. James Johns was arrested on the spot. Officers then rounded up Susan D'Aquila and her friends who were at the river that night. The accomplices immediately pointed the finger at Susan and James.
They were trying to save themselves. A number of them were in trouble with the police.
Were they upstanding individuals? Certainly not. But the facts are the facts. Susan D'Aquila was culpable. She was the mastermind. She did this for no other reason than the money.
At Susan's trial, prosecutors called several people who testified that Susan talked about killing Tony for his money.
I remember the pension was worth about $19,000, and the sad thing was that was worth it to Susan DiAquila. That was enough money to justify doing this.
In Susan's eyes, money didn't mean anything. Friends were more important than money.
The state's key witness was David Hurd, previously in trouble with the law, who claimed he saw everything. He told the jury how Susan and James forced Tony into the river.
Tony went underwater and came up and said, "Help me, please help me." And they sat there, the two of them sat there and watched him drown. David Hurd indicated right after this incident happened, she indicated, "Thank God it's over, now I'm a rich bitch."
On my mother's grave, that never happened.
One eyewitness against her had written her letters saying that he knew she didn't do it, and the judge did not allow those letters in.
I had letters written from David. He goes, "God knows you're innocent, and I will stick by you in the truth."
But according to the judge, Susan's attorney had presented the letters too late to be used in her defense.
I mean, if you're on a jury and you hear somebody testify that the defendant is guilty, and then somebody brings up letters that this person has written saying, "I know you didn't do it," what are you going to think as a juror? It's not likely you're going to give his testimony much credibility. So I think it would have made a big difference.
The jury found her guilty of first-degree murder, and it was our position that these facts were brutal and heinous and warranted an extended sentence.
The judge agreed. With some very harsh words for Susan DiAquila, he sentenced her to 60 years in prison.
I think there was a lot of preconceptions and bias against Susan because of her lifestyle.
Susan believes that the court might have been prejudiced against her because she was gay.
Nobody was looking at that in terms of any motivation or anything like that. It was like, okay, well, that was no big deal.
4 months later, James Johns pled guilty. Because he was 60 years old, the judge sentenced him to only 20 years.
All justice was done, and I think they should have given both of them the electric chair.
She did not have a fair trial. So many things were arrayed against Susan. In terms of witnesses lying, and in terms of not providing any kind of defense by her attorney.
Certain murders rise to the level of people just have their breath taken away, and people stop and pause and think, how could someone do that? And that was this case.
Susan was incarcerated at Lincoln Correctional Center and has served 20 years. She utilized her time in prison to research her case and write appeals petitions. All have been denied. But her current attorney is hoping that David's letters, among other issues, will be instrumental in obtaining clemency.
Since she's been in there, she's helped so many other women. It's time for her to come home.
Susan's family maintains that she is wrongly convicted.
I can't see her hurting even an animal. You know, how could she hurt a human being? I can't. I'll go to my grave believing she's innocent.
She's missed out on her grandkids. She's missed everything.
I'm not gonna quit. I'll get the evidence. We got the letters. We'll get the truth. God knows the truth.